It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The following program has been pre-recorded. Thanks for tuning in this weekend to Let's Talk Portland, Odyssey Portland's weekly public affairs program. I'm Gary Bloxham. On the show this time, I'd like to welcome Dr. Richard Brandes. Dr. Brandes is a gastroenterologist with Adventist Health in Portland. Hey there, Dr. Brandes. Welcome to Let's Talk Portland.
Hey, Gary. Thanks for having me.
I thought we'd get started today by having you tell our audience about you. Tell us about your practice.
As you said, I'm a gastroenterologist over at Adventist in Southeast Portland. I am relatively new to the area. I was in private practice for a long time, but wanted to do something different, something a little more challenging in a good way. And I think Adventist is a really special place to work. I've been doing gastroenterology for about 15 years overall. Satisfying work, interesting work. And it brings a lot of satisfaction to me, and I feel like you can help a lot of people help them live healthier, better lives.
And maybe we should explain what gastroenterology is.
Sure. Right. So gastroenterology, it is, or GI, as we like to say. So really anything from the top to the bottom. So anything that involves the mouth all the way down to the backside, and also throwing in the liver, gallbladder, bile ducts. So any disorders, diseases, concerns, and importantly, screening tests that involve esophagus, stomach, small bowel, large intestine, or colon, that is all our domain.
How do you get inside to take a look at those areas?
Getting inside is not always the first step, but depending upon the symptoms and the concerns, that's certainly where you end up. So you can start with just imaging. You can do ultrasounds, you can do CTs, you can do MRIs. But sooner or later, by the time a patient lands in our office, we're probably talking about doing an endoscopy or a colonoscopy. So for those procedures, patient's asleep. They have no memory. They have no pain that anything happens. And once they're asleep and comfortable, we pass little cameras. They're usually about as big around as your index finger, but quite a bit longer. And we can get down and look at very easily. We can look at esophagus, stomach, and the first part of the small intestine. And then from the other end, we can do the colon and maybe a little bit of the small intestine from that end as well. Small intestine's big. Even though the small intestine says small, it's the longest one, coming in about 15 to 20 feet, and kind of do a little more specialized endoscopy to get there, not as a routine of a thing, but we can do that as well.
What's the difference between the small intestine and large intestine?
So small intestine starts just outside your stomach. Again, that thing's about 15 to 20 feet long. And primarily that is where we are breaking down food, collecting nutrients, collecting the things that the body needs. As building blocks. They get sent up to the liver from there, and the liver does, that's the factory for your body. So the liver takes all that stuff and builds it into the good things that you need to run the system. So beyond the small intestine, you get into the colon. The colon is two big things, waste management. That's where we're getting rid of the parts we can't use and form it into things that we're going to get rid of. But also a lot of water absorption in the colon. So big job of the colon is absorbing water. And that changes a lot of things if you drink a lot of water or don't drink a lot of water.
Is the colon part of the large or small intestine?
The colon is the large intestine. So those are interchangeable, like so many things. There's two names for it for reasons I'm not actually familiar with.
And you talked about screenings. What kind of screenings are there?
The big one that we do is screening colonoscopies, which most people have heard of and many people are scared of. But that's a pretty straightforward thing. Screening colonoscopy. So there's a lot of ways to screen for colon cancer. We can take a step back. You can do stool tests. There's two different types of stool tests. They test for different things. One tests for blood. Two of them test for breakdown products of blood or actually DNA that might be released by a cancer if there's one in there. And then you can do a colonoscopy. Colonoscopy, you're actually taking a look inside the colon. You're looking for polyps specifically. So polyps are little growths that aren't cancers, but depending upon what kind of polyp it is, it might turn into a cancer down the road. So if we see those, we take them out on the spot and check them out under the microscope, and that kind of depends when and if a patient has to come back.
How do you remove a polyp?
A couple different techniques. Primary one is a little tiny snare, so a little metal loop, and it extends all the way through the scope. We open it, loop it over that polyp, and then close it, and it just cuts right through it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's not painful.
It is not painful. There are none of that type of pain receptor in the colon. So, yeah, it works pretty well. And again, the patient's asleep. So, yeah, it's a vast majority of patients who have a polyp taken out never feel any adverse events related to that.
I can attest to that. I've had two colonoscopies and didn't feel a thing.
That's four colonoscopies in the room that have been on the receiving end. So yeah, it's easy. Really easy.
I did kind of wake up during my last one, though, which is kind of weird.
Uh-oh.
I didn't feel anything, but I was like, and just felt paralyzed.
Did you watch the movie?
Or no.
They just put you back to sleep?
They put me back to sleep.
That's good.
What movie were they showing? Or did they usually
It was you. It was you.
Oh,
it
was... I see. I didn't get to see that. No.
Right.
So let's talk about colon cancer. What is that?
So colon cancer still ranks in the top three cancers that kills both men and women in this country. So tumors form in the colon, usually from a polyp. It can take years and years to form a polyp and even more years to have that polyp turn into a cancer, which is why a screening colonoscopy is so important, because we can get in there and find those polyps and get them out of there. And effectively, colon cancer is largely preventable just by doing those tests.
Well, it's a pretty slow growing cancer, is that correct?
Correct. And that's why, we mentioned earlier, if you take a polyp out, depending upon the size, the number of polyps, the type of polyps, we might tell a patient to come back in 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. Or if there's nothing at all, then maybe 10 years, just because we know that it does take a long time for those things to transpire and to evolve.
Wow, 10 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, if you're completely clean and no polyps, then it's 10 years.
I go back every 5. I have some family history. My mom.
Correct. Yeah, and that's a big trump card right there, is that you need to, that's an important part of it, is that if you have a family history of colon cancer, then most people are going to be doing every 5 years.
Why is family history so important?
So there are definitely some identified genetic traits that result in familial colon cancers. And then there are colon cancers that we know run in families, but we can't tag it to a certain gene. But you can write out a pedigree and say, yeah, my dad's dad had it, my dad had it, and my sister had it. So, yeah, I'm going in every 5 years and making sure that I didn't get that gene either.
Family history is probably not the only sign, right? You should be looking for other things.
From a symptom standpoint, again, colon cancer is tricky because there's not a lot of symptoms of colon cancer until it's pretty advanced.
Okay.
If a colon tumor gets big enough that you're starting to get a blockage and things aren't working like they should, and people feel bloated, they can't eat, they don't want to eat. It's colon cancer by the time you have a symptom is a pretty big deal.
Okay.
Which, of course, now I beat the same drum, which is why I just get in and get that colonoscopy done early.
Is colon cancer on the rise?
It's actually not. We're finally getting a little bit of control over it over the last probably decade or so. Funny numbers, though, it's been on the decline, but that decline is slowing. So we're not, it's starting to kind of turn back up. It's still on the decline, but we're not finding as much as we did.
Any idea why it's on the decline or maybe slowing down its decline?
Certainly the decline is because we're getting in there. We're stopping it before it starts. Okay. We're getting polyps. They don't ever have a chance to do their damage. And screening colonoscopies are a big, big part of that.
Yeah. Are there other options besides colonoscopy?
There are. So, we kind of touched on that a little bit. Other options besides screening colonoscopy, you can do what's called a FIT, fecal immuno. I'm going to blow it. Fecal immunohemoglobin testing.
That's amazing you remembered that.
You stall out. That's a yearly test. It's just you put in a stool sample and you check that. You can do fecal occult blood testing, which is testing also for blood. It's a little bit less specific Then the FIT, fecal occult blood, is testing for blood. FIT's testing for processed blood. We're getting into the weeds here a little bit. And then you can do something. There's a new one that's called Cologuard. I mean, people are seeing that on TV. There's lots of advertising that. Cologuard's a pretty good test. And it's going to be a better test in a few years. Cologuard is testing for blood as well as colon cancer DNA. And so those are all useful tests. Depending upon which one, you might do one every year. Might do it every 3 years. If it turns up positive, you're going to get a colonoscopy. There still are CT colonography or colonoscopy, depending on what you call it. So the CT scanner can, in theory, screen for polyps and tumors. Of course, the trick there is you have to do the prep for that CT colonography. So if you do the prep and they find something, then you got to do another prep on a different day and still come back and get a colonoscopy. So that's a little tricky. And the stool tests, again, they're useful. They're good tests. But if they find something, then you got to get a colonoscopy. And they're not checking for polyps. So if one of those tests is positive, the big concern is that you've already got a cancer in there.
Okay. So many people, when they think about colonoscopies or start talking about colonoscopies, are terrified of the prep. So how do you set your patients' minds at ease when it comes to the prep and for the procedure?
A lot of that, so the procedure is pretty straightforward. It's, patients are sleeping the whole time. They're comfortable, with rare exception. They are sleeping the whole time, and they're comfortable, and that's the easy part. And admittedly, the hard part's the day beforehand. The prep is getting better. As I say to all my patients these days, I'm not going to tell you the prep is a party, but it's less miserable than it used to be.
Yeah, that's true.
And we're finding some tricks here and there. So there's some studies coming out on like low residue diets. So we're finding ways to say, hey, you can probably eat these things, but you got to stay away from this other stuff that forms bulk and is gonna confound the prep. Definitely the sort of thing you want to talk to your gastroenterologist about. But there's some gray zones that are developing. But mostly it's not just that giant gallon of nasty flavored stuff anymore, which is what everybody thinks of.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of small volume preps, stuff that's half that much, and stuff that tastes better. You can use stuff that just tastes like Gatorade. You can use actual Gatorade mixed with other things. There's a new one now that we're using a lot of. It's just pills.
Oh, wow.
You take a pill a minute for 12 minutes, drink a whole bunch of fluid afterwards, and then a few hours later you do the same thing again. So it's what you're drinking, what you're getting in your system is much, much improved. The outcome is the same.
Yeah.
You cannot change the outcome.
It really is. It's different. My first one 10 years ago was like drinking salty grape juice.
Yes.
And it was just like, oh boy, yes, this is not good. And this last time it was like Gatorade.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was still salty, but it was lemon lime and,
right,
and the volume was much less.
Yes. We're getting there. Yeah. Someday there'll be like just one magic pill that has no outcome or a magic wand or something. But we're getting there bit by bit.
We're talking today with Dr. Richard Brandis, gastroenterologist at Adventist Health in Portland. So tell us about, talk to us about how diet can impact gut health.
Diet and gut health is a tricky one, but also intuitive, I think. I try to spend as much time as we can talking to patients about diet. A lot of questions of what's the best diet, how do I, what's the best for keeping my gut healthy. The funny point in all of it is that we do know that there are healthy bacteria. They're supposed to be in your gut. They do good things to you. Specifically in your gut, we're talking about the colon. So the colon has healthy bacteria that are in there. We also know that over time, the variety of bacteria that are in our colons is becoming less and less. Probably due to our diet, probably due to our overuse of antibiotics. A lot of that has improved in recent years, but there was a period of time where the second you had a sniffle, you went and tried to get some antibiotics. And so how do you keep that flora? How do you keep that little environment healthy? So a healthy diet is obviously where that starts. So we're talking fresh fruits and vegetables. We're talking lean proteins. I like to tell my patients to shop the outside of the grocery store. The second you go down the aisles, the second you're eating stuff that comes out of boxes, out of plastic wrappers, cans, even frozen stuff, as soon as it's processed, you're getting into trouble. It doesn't have the nutrients you want. It's got a bunch of preservatives in it.
So stay on the perimeter.
Stay on the perimeter. Shop the outside of the grocery store. And I'm prone to saying, you know, if you look at the label of something and you can't pronounce one of those words, then you might want to think twice about putting it in your face hole. I mean, it's, if I can't pronounce it, I get edgy.
Yeah, I could.
Why is that in there?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And farmers markets are a good place to go.
Absolutely. Farmers markets are great. Co-ops, I mean, this time of year, there's a lot of startups again on like winter co-ops. I know several restaurants in town that kind of run those, and you can do pickups that are local. And it's cool. It's cool to go out and meet the people that are growing your food. Like, that's a
for sure.
very fun experience.
Yeah.
I have a big garden at home, and I love that. I love hauling stuff up out of the garden, and you're cooking it the same day, and you can't replace that.
Yeah.
Food, eating should be fun, right? Eating with people, cooking your own food should be enjoyable. And I think the ritual of doing that tends to lead to eating better, and that's important for gut health.
What sort of impact is of like fast food and stuff? What does that do to you?
The opposite of what we've just been talking about, right?
Okay.
So anything that's prepared, right? So fast food, Grubhub, takeout, all that stuff is convenient, but I think it does a couple of things. One, there's a lot of not great nutrition there, right? There's a lot of fillers. There's a lot of high fructose corn syrup. There's extra starches. There's extra sugars. There's tons of super interesting but depressing articles out there about like the food scientists whose job it is to add a little bit of this, a little bit of that. How do I adjust the crunch factor to make people just want to keep eating this stuff? And it's frightening.
Wow.
And a lot of those will have a big, what we call an osmotic load. So the stuff that you can't digest that is going to kind of just surge through you, and you know, all the old lore and truths of like Taco Bell and things like that. And it's like, well, there's a reason, right? Like, I'll ask my patients, we'll be having these talks, and I just say, well, hang on, is there food in your food?
Hopefully.
Right. But how much, right? So it's depending upon what you're eating, you know, the nutrition as it relates to how much filler's in there and how much just poor quality nutrition, those are big deals. And so, yeah, the fast food industry is rough if you're worried about your gut health.
It seems like healthy eating is kind of on the rise.
I think so.
Would you agree with that?
For sure. And it's, you know, and I don't know that there's any one right way to eat healthy, but it's funny because everybody who comes to me and says, hey, I've made these changes and I feel better. Yeah, it works. And it doesn't seem to matter what diet they're doing. It's the diet that you enjoy. Going back to that point, right? Like as long as you're eating something that makes you happy and makes you want to eat, well, great. And if you feel better on it, you know, that's one step farther. So if you can be healthy and like how it tastes and it's not, you know, like eating a piece of cardboard, then yeah, that's a win.
Yeah. What do you think gut health was like? This is going to make you hypothesize, but what do you think gut health was like in the 60s and 70s when convenience food came out, like TV dinners and boxed meals and
Man,
things like that?
Great question, right? Because it's, and I, you know, I grew up with that, right? Mom, dad, go out and here's your Hungry Man.
Mm-hmm.
You and your brother can heat this up in the oven, not even in the microwave.
Right.
But, you know, it's a funny dovetail of so many things, right? So that's the front edge of convenience food. And I can remember growing up when my hometown got its first McDonald's, it was a big deal. Right, like, oh, well, we got to go find out what's going on there, and yeah. So the TV dinners, also the time that antibiotics are really starting to trend. We're getting more and more as we hit the 80s, and so I think gut health at that point in time was probably pretty good. What's happened right after that is, I think, maybe the big question.
Okay.
And I'm sure that there's an epidemiologist out there who has looked into this and can say, hey, here's exactly how those trends happened. An infectious disease doc who's fascinated with that. And it's a great question, Gary.
I would imagine that any sort of colon screening probably wasn't happening too frequently back then.
Or no. I mean, the big paper that kind of showed that there's a benefit to colonoscopy as colon cancer screens came out in 2000. And so there was some colonoscopy going on in the 70s, not a lot. It really started to pick up in the 90s, and then 2000 was where we were able to validate, hey, this does change lives.
So I want to ask this question, it could be a little bit delicate, but what do bowel movements tell a person about their health, their gut health especially?
I don't know that you can say that a bowel movement tells you any one thing right away unless you're acutely ill, right? So that's the big one is, well, yeah, if you're really sick and you're having diarrhea, then we know immediately that something's off, probably acutely. Now, size, shape, frequency, there are some variables there, and there are, you know, we can really get into the delicacies of like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. This is a popular topic these days. I think there's a lot of news out there about it. There's a lot of internet discussion about it, and it's a real entity. But just because your bowel movements change doesn't mean that's why. And so I don't know that your bowel movements yourself are going to tell you a whole lot, just from what you see on a day-to-day basis. Now, that being said, I mean, you can do cultures. There are labs that will run a whole biome. They'll tell you, hey, here's exactly what bacteria we grew out of your colon. And is that healthy? Is that not healthy? And not a lot of that is well validated. But I think if you're consistent, I think if everything's the same day in and day out, that you're doing something right. If there's a lot of variability, then yeah, maybe it's time to have a discussion with your primary care doc, find a gastroenterologist, and say, hey, what do I need to be doing differently? Do I need to eat differently? Do I just need simply more water? Or do I need to take a look in there and see if there's some type of inflammation or, important disease going on?
I interviewed a couple of people, young people. The topic was colon cancer in younger people.
Yeah.
And their advice was look in the toilet.
Yeah. Well, sure.
Inspect what's going on.
Sure. Yeah. I think we joke about that, except it's not a joke. Is there's two kinds of people in this world. And there's the people who look and the people who don't. And
yeah,
I'd say be a looker. You know, it's going to tell you something, and it might just be all right. Things are the same.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty great advice.
It is. It is
from people who, definitely had a problem. Talk a bit about probiotics. How do you get probiotics, and should we supplement those?
So probiotics, depending upon the circumstances, this is one of these fields that came out, and there's a lot of things in favor of it, and then there's been a little bit of a pullback. But I still think overall that they're good. I think that anytime you've had an acute change, and this is more kind of my observations. I can't say that I've got a big background of data on this one, but I think anytime there's been an acute change, whether you had to have your gallbladder taken out or you had acute diarrhea and just got better on your own, you will have changed the balance of what's going on in there. And I think those are great times to take some probiotics. If you've had to take antibiotics, so you took antibiotics because you had an illness, you had a sinus infection, or a surgery that required them, that's a great time to take some probiotics because the balance of that good flora, that good bacteria in your colon, that balance is now changed. So those are great times to take probiotics. There are some people, there's a great study that came out probably 5 years ago. There's some people, they take probiotics and it makes kind of their symptoms worse. Their bloating and diarrhea, there's a subset of people who get worse on probiotics. And we don't quite understand why, but we see that correlation. So I think across the board, there are definitely some very good indications for taking them.
Okay. We've got a couple minutes. I want you to pretend like I've never had a colonoscopy and kind of convince me that I need to pay attention to my colon health.
All right. So you've never had a colonoscopy. You are 45 years or older. Colon cancer is in the top three cancers that kills men in this country still. And most likely, as a guy who's 45 or older, you've been eating a pretty American-style diet that's probably more high in fat and high in red meat, and throw some barbecue in there on the weekends. And those are all important risk factors for colon cancer. Do you have a family history of colon cancer, Gary?
Yes.
Who in your family had colon cancer?
My mother.
Your mother had colon cancer. So this is a big deal, and colon cancer is preventable. By and large, the vast majority of colon cancer is completely preventable. We can go in there, do a colonoscopy, and we're looking for polyps. Polyps are little growths that aren't cancers, but we take them out early so they never get a chance to turn into a cancer, which a certain subset of them will. Hard parts the day beforehand. You got to drink all that stuff to get you cleaned out, but once that's over, coming in for a colonoscopy is a snap. You go to sleep, you wake up and say, when are we starting this thing? And it's already done.
I'm convinced. Well, I can also say that it's probably the best nap you're ever going to get.
It's amazing, a good nap. Right? Yes. The propofol nap is a thing. Yeah.
It's an uncomfortable conversation to have often, but you've made it nice and easy.
Well, great. I mean, and that's what we do, right? I think putting people at ease about this is the best thing we can do. Just getting that conversation started for people who aren't ready to have it.
Yeah.
It's a big deal for us.
Well, thanks for being on the show and helping us understand this.
Awesome. Thank you, Gary.
We've been talking today with Dr. Richard Brandes, gastroenterologist at Adventist Health in Portland. Thanks again.
Thank you.
If you'd like to hear this interview again, just search for Let's Talk Portland on the Odyssey app. Let's Talk Portland is an Odyssey Portland public affairs program.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.